mortgage insurance industry
Love
for more than 50
Radio.
Years. United Guarantee has evolved to be ready for the next half century. They employ more than 200 underwriting personnel who collaborate with each customer to ensure a 24-hour turnaround on a full file submission service that no other company delivers. United Guarantee would like to wish all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving and a restful and safe holiday. For more information about United Guarantee, visit www.ugcorp.com or call your account executive. We're grateful for their sponsorship of the broadcast. Also, a quick thank you to Velma Marketing, Velma.com. Velma stands for Virtual Electronic Marketing Assistant. If you're looking for a marketing solution that will help differentiate your company, check out Velma at Velma.com. It's the easiest and most powerful marketing platform that I've seen, and I have worked with them. I use it, and I think you should too. Of course, each of our regular contributors, we've got Joe Farr here with us. Andy Schell's not going to be joining us, but we do have Tony Garitano, and I'm hoping for Paul Mallow too. So I'm going to be watching the dashboard here and looking to make sure that we can get them on the line as they call in. So thank you all for joining us, and what I'd like to do is go ahead and get started. Oh, also, as an announcement, just make sure that everyone's aware of the MBA's Independent Mortgage Banker Conference that's coming up in at the Hotel Del Coronado in California, December 3rd through the 5th, so that should be a great event for the industry as well. So Tony Garitano, I think I've got you on the line. I'll go ahead and ask you to mute. Sorry, we didn't get a chance to connect in advance. But also then want to make sure that we get Joe Farr on the line here. So, Joe, thank you so much for being here. Jump in any time. You get to be my backup today.
Well, you're doing a great job so far.
Well, other than kind of tripping over the initial timing, I was listening to my cell phone, and I could hear the show had started, even though the voice on the phone had said that we still had 1 minute to go. So I'm not quite sure what is going on with the timing. So we're on air and ready to go.
Okay. Well, and I'll talk a little bit about interest rates and where MBS prices are. Right now, I'm just looking at the path of movement today on MBS prices, and I've never seen a 2.5 hour span where we had less movement than what I'm looking at right now. So it may be indicative of the week ahead, but ordinarily you expect to see in holiday weeks, low trading volumes, which generally create a little volatility, but right now we're about where we ended the day on Friday. We're better than we were for the first couple hours of the trading session. And we started out about down 3:30 seconds for much of the early morning, and about 10:15 we jumped up to flat to where we ended the day on Friday. No economic news came out today. We've just had a Treasury auction, but I don't know what the results of that Treasury auction were. It's a 2-year, so it shouldn't have a big effect on MBS prices. And we'll talk a little bit about last week. We had a 9/32 improvement in prices that equates to 28 basis points and about 4 basis points, maybe 5, in improvement in mortgage rates. The interesting thing last week, Alice, was the global economic news that we received last week, especially from Japan, was pretty weak. And that added to the weakness in China, the weakness in Europe, has kind of offset what has been fairly strong economic data here in the United States. In the U.S., the data this week was all either, better. It was better than last month and pretty much better than expectations. The global slowdown, and even though there's strength in the U.S., is weighing down inflation and the concerns about inflation. As we saw last week, both CPI, core CPI, and core PPI, they did increase some, but not much, and they remain well under the Fed's target of 2%. And, that lets the Fed, gives them a little more latitude as far as, maintaining their current policies. In the U.S., the data, as I mentioned, was pretty good, especially in the housing market. Starting off with existing home sales, it didn't start off, but existing home sales rose to the highest level of the year. single family component of housing starts was also at the highest level of the year. Building permits rose to the highest level in 5 years. And then the National Association of Home Builders Housing Index came out, and it indicates builders are very confident about the current situation and the future market conditions. And those last three, everything but existing home sales, are leading indicators, and so it's pointing to a pretty good housing market for the months to come. The other big news that came out last week was the minutes of the October 29th Fed meeting. They didn't reveal too much new. The Fed was a little more bullish on the labor market, and soon after the minutes came out, MBS prices reacted by dropping just a bit. But as I mentioned, overall in the week, we were up. And then if you look toward this week, being Thanksgiving week, it's a short week, as I mentioned, and that often creates some volatility. I hadn't seen it so far today. But the market's going to be closed. It'll be a full session on Wednesday, but it'll be closed on Thursday and a short session on Friday. Most all the economic information's bunched into Tuesday and Wednesday, almost all of it on Wednesday, to be quite honest. Tomorrow we do see third quarter GDP. The second revision to third quarter GDP comes out tomorrow. We also have consumer confidence coming out tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, boy, it is packed. We've got, most importantly, probably the core PCE, another of the Fed's favored inflation indicators. It's expected to show modest inflation. And then on also on Wednesday, we have new home sales, pending home sales, jobless claims, durable orders, Chicago PMI, final look at consumer sentiment. So that's going to be a pretty packed morning for economic data on Wednesday. There are Treasury auctions, as I mentioned, one today. There'll be one tomorrow and one on Wednesday. The 5 tomorrow and the 7-year on Wednesday. So, again, it's not uncommon to see volatility in days like now. Since we've been on the air and I've been talking about a flat market, we've increased 2/32 in price. So maybe it's still going to come today.
Well, that all the more reason everybody needs your service, right? Just to be watching your phones this week, because it sounds like a lot can happen, especially Wednesday. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you think you can relax and you just never really can, right? There's no status quo in our business these days.
It's constantly moving.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your report, Joe. I'm looking forward to having you on the show as we interview David Lord this in the second half. So thanks so much for the update. I feel like we're ready to go with interest rates and cross our fingers that it's all just good news the rest of the week. So thank you so much. Okay.
Yes, Alice. All right.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS QuoteLine delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS QuoteLine, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS QuoteLine today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lincoln on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lincoln.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Alice Alvey here with Indicom Mortgage U, hosting for Dave today as he is out of the office. Dave will be back next week. So right now I'd like to introduce Paul Mallow. Paul, are you out there? I think I'm running the dashboard so I can
hear you. I am here.
All right. Thank you. Paul Mallow with IMF News. What is happening? We can't wait to hear your wit and wisdom for the morning or the afternoon. It's been a long day already.
I'm going to go boring today. There's some interesting stuff out there. I mean, Thanksgiving week traditionally is a slow news week, but it's also funny. Sometimes when companies have bad news, they drop it in an SEC filing the Friday after Thanksgiving, because a lot of the a lot of the trade press takes Friday off. We're not publishing that day. We're publishing Monday through Wednesday. But I always tell people, look for that Friday after Thanksgiving. Sometimes you see the bad news, the SEC filing there. Actually, I'm going to be out of pocket Friday, so I'm not going to look at any SEC filings. But if I do see something good over when I get back on the weekend, I will post something. But as
All
far
right,
as
I'm
news
sure
this
you
week,
deserve the break.
Yeah. This week we crunched the FHA numbers. Maybe not a surprise. The first 9 months were pretty good. The third quarter was very good compared to the second quarter. We had $38.3 billion in FHA production in the third quarter. That's up almost 17% from 2Q. Year over year, that's no shock. Business is down. You know, everyone last week was talking about the MMIF of the FHA. It's now back in the black, but not by enough. And no one...
Right.
No one is expecting, I mean, they want, but no one's expecting a premium cut because the fund is still way below that 2%. I think they're at 0.47 or something like that. They need to get back to 2% capital before anyone's going to entertain cuts in the FHA premiums. At least that's the speculation. And even late last week, we had a story on the website about one of the spending resolutions have actually a small increase in FHA costs, and that caused a little bit of a brouhaha on Friday afternoon. One pending deal that's out there is Arvest Mortgage, or Arvest Bank has got a mortgage sub. They're entertaining and have been for several months doing the $28 billion servicing sale. This would be a sale where they sell the MSRs and retain the subservicing contract. There's been a few of those done this year. There hasn't been done lately. They've been working on this deal for several months. It may or may not come off, and that's an interesting one to watch. They wouldn't talk to us about it, but they didn't deny it either. I should point that out. We also had coverage of the recent mortgage conference, the Structured Finance Industry Group and Information Management Network. They had a conference in New York recently about non-agency production, and it's funny, we sent Thomas Russell there of our staff, and you know, there's some positives, there's some negatives. You know, investors are you know, still looking at standards and disclosures. But, you know, there's been quite a few jumbo deals done in the last 2 months, and we'll see what happens between now and year end. You know, it's the jumbo MBS market is there. It's not booming, but at least it's, you know, on life support to some degree. There's a few large servicing deals out there, IMA, Interactive Mortgage Advisors. Mountain View has got a billion-dollar deal out. IMA has got almost $5 billion in deals out. That's interesting. There's a number of deals pending before year end. We'll see if they all get done. CPB's got an e-closing initiative that's plodding along, and there was a recent report on it by DBRS. We'll see how that plays out. In the short stakes section of MyMF News, Fannie and Freddie's common stock is down a little bit today. We just mentioned that because, you know, last week we had the senator from South Dakota, Johnson, basically saying, you know, listen, there's no progress on GSE reform. You know, why don't you start looking at getting these things out of conservatorship and talk to Treasury? That was his conversation with Mel Watt of the FHFA. Tim Johnson said that. And that caused a big spike in Fannie Freddie stock prices and lots of speculation on whether it's going to happen or not. No one knows. But this morning the stock was flat or down. Stern AG put out a report on AltaSource Portfolio Solutions. That's one of the Ocwen spinoffs, and all the Ocwen-related stocks have been clobbered this year. I mean, the investors have been devastated. AltaSource recently said they're getting out of the force-placed insurance business, and that was a big negative. And that's about it. One other tidbit we had in the short take section of MyMF News, Royal Bank of Scotland is shutting down its U.S. mortgage trading desk, and they're based in Greenwich Capital, and that's the old Greenwich Capital Trading Platform. And we mentioned that because RBS and Greenwich are defendants in some of the FHFA lawsuits having to do with subprime issuance. And a lot of those cases have been settled, but RBS has not settled yet. And that could be a huge settlement because they were a major player in the non-agency space during the boom years. So that's all the highlights there, Alice. So if you have any questions or comments, let me know.
Well, I do. I have a quick question. So you kind of see that FHA is not out of the woods, but do you think they're off the radar at least for a little bit, where Congress is going to stop bugging or making them a target for having additional change or tightening underwriting at all?
Well, are you suggesting that Congress is going to play politics with you?
Kind of keep having to try and stay off of that court, don't they?
Yeah. Now, listen, I mean, they're going to continue to make an issue of it. And the good news is that FHA is back in the black. They're not, mm-hmm. Their underwriting has been so tightened up that they're not going to lose it. They should not lose any money going forward. And the fund will get back in the black by 2016-17, whatever the new target date is. But anytime they go up for appropriations, there's going to be questions about how they're doing, and it's going to continue to be a political issue. And they're going to roll FHA reform in with GSE reform, but no one in their right mind thinks we're going to see a bill passed between now and the next president's elected. Everyone expects this thing to just fester and meander on. Until we have a new president in 2016. So, but yeah, it'll be politics, and it'll be an issue to watch. And I'm sure there'll be some hearings next year. But I don't know much more than that.
Yeah. Well, those actuarial reports. Yeah. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I was going to ask a question about something else. If you want to finish on that, but.
Oh, I would just, and then I'll jump. The actuarial reports always show that, house prices do nothing but go up significantly every year, even to come up with that number in the black for FHA. So that's always an interesting side note that no one seems to pay attention to it. All the projections that they have to do out into the future always show that everything's going to be real rosy. So anyway, that's the story still to be told. So go ahead, Joe.
Well, I was going to ask Paul if he's heard anything about, you mentioned Ocwen getting out of the forced place insurance business, which I understand. But also I'm hearing, I think it was a congressional committee meeting where some people were calling for the end of forced place insurance. And just wanted to ask the question of who's talking about, well, what do you do then, given a servicer's obligated to maintain insurance on the property for the investor, for the government in many cases?
Well, that's interesting, Joe. I didn't hear about a congressional push to end forced place insurance, and it wouldn't be surprising if someone did.
Elizabeth Warren.
I wasn't at that hearing. Our GSE editor, Charles Wisniewski, was there. That doesn't surprise me that she asked about that. But it's funny you mentioned forced place, because I know there was something in the new CFPB rules that came out last week. There was some, if you read some of the language, it almost sounded like the CFPB would like to change forced place insurance and not have it be slammed on the consumer because he hasn't paid. But the language is, it has to do whether he's got the ability to pay or something. And the language is real fuzzy, and I have one of our editors studying the language to do a follow-up. But, there could be something afoot, but, I don't think Congress isn't going to pass anything, let's face it. I mean, they're at war. They're at war at every – the only thing they're going to continue to pass is spending bills. And, it's just awful here. And you guys aren't here, but you see all the headlines. They're not passing anything unless it's a crisis, and this isn't a crisis. I mean, it's bad for some people. I mean, I'm an Ocwen customer, and I've written about it, and I've been current, and I have a great payment history. And they tried to hit me with forced place insurance, claiming I didn't pay something on time, and it turned out not to be true. And I've since talked to other people in the mortgage industry who also are Ocwen customers, and they try to, force place them too. And, now I'm putting on my customer editor hat here, and it's, I don't know what's wrong with mortgage servicers who can't see that an insurance payment either isn't due, and they start threatening people with forced place. I mean, there seems to me there's some real abuses going on in that field, and there have been in the past.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be a gap in the process. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for your feedback, Paul and Joe, for your questions. Anything else before we move off? Okay.
That's enough.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Bye, Joe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Goodbye. So, all right, next up is going to be me helping you with a little bit of what's going on in the industry. As Paul just said, there are not a lot of pieces of legislation that are going to get very far as we sit through this next 2 years in this congressional session. So what I wanted to bring you up to date on in my segment here was the Texas Warehouse Bank Conclave that was held last Wednesday. Dave and I both, Dave was the moderator. I sat on a panel that talked about QM and non-QM loans, along with Brian Webster from the CFPB, Ari Karen from Offutt Curran, and Mitch Kiter from Wiener Brodsky. And so it was just a, having those three up there and me trying to represent the lender side of this, as we had the regulator and the two attorneys, I thought, oh my gosh, we're getting hit with regulations and law. How do we actually try and originate in the non-QM space? And the thing I want to make sure everybody was really aware of is CFPB is really quiet on that subject. Non-QM loans are about the borrower's ability to repay. I was surprised how much Ari and Mitch focused on the underwriting aspect of it, and that they really felt there really wasn't a huge significant, you know, again, I'm going to paraphrase here, significant risk in terms of class action, because the underwriting side is really those one-off loans. There isn't something that's happening on every single deal. You hope, right? As long as your company has written policies and procedures and you're managing that non-QM space. But CFPB was very quiet. They weren't going to give us any guidance on kind of what kind of a DTI is too high. For those of you thinking about the non-QM space, those are things that I think you definitely need to get a lot of feedback on as you go to implement that, because you are going to have to depend on those who are doing it and historical data. They did support over and over. A lot of it's going to be history in terms of proving that your underwriting is going to work. So we'll have to stay tuned with that one. CFPB was very participatory within the mini correspondent panel. So again, Brian Webster, Ari, and Mitch sitting on that panel, as well as one of the Texas Capital Bank representatives. And that was very interesting. The main thing I want to try and share with you there from as mini correspondent businesses is all of you really need, who are in that space or considering that space, need to take a look at timelines. I was surprised how much this was a focus. The idea that, say I have a customer who comes on board, they're a mini correspondent, but maybe I'm still perhaps helping in the process once the loan gets into my pipeline a little bit further. Maybe I'm helping them with redisclosures, or I'm really rechecking files, or I'm assisting somehow within the closing process. And you're looking at the idea that I bring somebody on board, and then they're going to graduate to become a full correspondent. Now, for those of you, just for terminology's sake, we say mini correspondent, usually by saying the lender's going to handle the underwriting risk, but me as a company, as a correspondent, I'm going to handle the application, the processing, and the closing, and the post-closing components. I'm running a warehouse line. It's not a dedicated line. That was definitely a subject of conversation. But I think one of the main things was you have to have policies and procedures that spell all out of the responsibilities out. One of my customers already called. They're on the correspondent side, mini correspondent side. They're being asked by a state regulator, prove to me you're doing enough work to be in compliance with CFPB. They're not going after the investor. They're going after that company itself. And then the component of the timeline, that if you're operating a warehouse line, are your entities that you're doing the underwriting for, are they working their way to being a full correspondent someday? Do any of your entities work to become that process? They saw this mini correspondent as a process. So if nobody ever makes it to what I call being fully grown up, right? Mini correspondents, sometimes those are folks that want to be big, but they don't want to grow up because they don't want their risk averse. That which is fine if someone can stay there, but they have to be operating very much on their own from origination through closing and post-closing, with the exception of that underwriting risk. So keep that in mind. If you have any questions, I'm happy to take your calls and your emails on that. Joe, I didn't know if you had a chance to attend any of that event, the Texas education event that they held, or if you had any questions along that line related to the warehouse lenders.
I wasn't able to attend, Alice. They do have a very good secondary conference coming up in early February that I'm going to go to, and I encourage everyone to consider that. It's an outstanding conference. But no, I wasn't able to make that one, Alice.
Okay. Well, yeah, I didn't get to stay for the whole thing, so I didn't know if you snuck in there as well. So in any case, yeah, check out the conferences. They're very valuable, very knowledgeable, great group of people that I had the opportunity to work with. So be very careful in that non-QM and space and in the mini-core space. Last but not least, make sure you check out Fannie Mae's Lender Sentiment Survey. It was published in October. It has great information to check out to see where lenders and banks feel their risks are from large, medium, and small companies. And there's a lot of good data in there where you can kind of compare yourself to your peers. Again, that's the Fannie Mae Lender Sentiment Survey about mortgage risk and what are the items that companies are concerned with today, and certainly compliance and volume decrease and repurchase risk are still high on the scale. So that's my tidbit for today, and I'll move on. Thank you all for your time, and we'll be talking with David Lord after we talk with Tony Garitano in our next session.
If you have questions about mortgage regulations, Indicom Mortgage U has free answers. If you need ideas about how to reinvent your organization, Indicom Mortgage U will share great ideas. When you need help at any step of the loan process, give us a call or send an email. The Indicom team of experts have been helping mortgage players from origination through servicing for over 30 years. Your success is our focus. Whether it's a quick question or long-term support, portfolio, conventional, or government lending, it's a competitive market. So let Indicom Mortgage U give you the edge.
Yes, you can reach Indicom Mortgage U at mortgage-u.com or call me at 800-278-0200. Thank you, and I'm going to make sure I get this dashboard working. So, Tony Garitano, give me 1 second. Tony, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me out?
Yes, thank you. How are you today?
I am well. How are you?
I am fine. I'm filling in for Dave today. You know, he's just out for the one day, thank goodness. But I'm happy to help fill in and hear what you have to say today. I know you've got a couple of questions lined up for us in the tech world. For those of you who don't know, Tony Garitano is the founder of Progress in Lending. And Tony, you want to tell folks a little bit about Progress in Lending? We haven't had a chance to give you a couple minutes in the air to do that lately.
Progress in Lending was formed almost 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, and it's really an industry think tank, Alice. It was really about bringing people together who wanted to discuss technology and strategy and how we can move forward as an industry and grow our respective businesses and be proactive about the changes that the mortgage industry is facing. And we've grown since then, and We're a media company with a clear focus on thought leadership,
and with a lot of focus on the tech side too. So, share with us a little bit about how much technology has advanced, you know, and then we'll talk a little bit about the future.
You know, I think, you know, it's probably going to be strange coming from me, but I don't think technology has advanced very much this year. I think that technology has really risen to the compliance challenge and has tried to stay one step ahead, and some technology vendors have done a better job versus others, and I think some technology vendors have used these, you know, new regulations as an avenue to innovate, whereas others have not. So I think technology certainly has grown by leaps and bounds in terms of its capability and its adoption, but I think that has been out of necessity.
So that's interesting. So you don't feel like they've really come up with anything new this year. So do you expect more or less than in 2015? I guess we've just been trying to cope, right, with the regulations.
I think a lot of the vendors that I talk to are gearing up for the new disclosures in August.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be a very big focus for a lot of people in the first half of the year. And I think that people are looking forward to that deadline being behind them, so they can, you know, kind of get back to business as usual. I mean, there's an underlying perception that more regulation is going to be on the way, and a lot of people are looking at the CFPB e-closing pilot to see what happens with that, in terms of mortgage technology anyway. And I think it's going to be a very interesting year because lenders are increasingly using technology as a vehicle to maintain compliance, so I think that that's a good thing. I mean, if you talk about something as quote-unquote futuristic as a full electronic mortgage, well, that's not really futuristic, Alice. We've done those
right.
before.
right,
it's
right.
It's just a question
and, yeah.
of us doing more of them.
Right.
So I think the lenders really have to catch up to the technology, not the other way around.
And feel comfortable that their customers will embrace it, too. I think there's a fear in
right.
there of, you know, that they may be able to, but will their customers want to go as far as a full e-closing? Maybe a certain segment, but, you know, we all still deal with very traditional customers who still like their paper.
I agree, but I think, you know, those customers are, you know, those are the customers that are going away.
Right.
And I would like to see the mortgage industry be more prepared for the new customers coming down the pike. You know, even if they were to offer something like an e-closing as an option,
mm-hmm.
I think that they would find that it would be a great value add, and that they could use it as a way to pick up some market share, especially with volume going down.
So do you see that as kind of running in 2015 at the same time as the integrated disclosures have to come out? Because, you know, my feeling is, yes, we'll get them implemented August 1st, but then we'll be in cleanup mode right through September and October as we figure out all the bugs and someone didn't think of this quirk on a strange transaction somewhere in, you know, a small rural town. Right? I mean, you can have all those strange stars line and someone finds a bug in the system. So I'm sure we'll be working through some operational changes and, you know, then the year's over. So do you see e-closings as kind of running parallel this year or really more of a 2016
opportunity?
I think
they are going to run somewhat parallel, Alice, because the disclosures speak directly to the closing process.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, is very new and different as compared to some of the other regulations that we've seen that have spoken more to the front end of the process. So I think that, or at least I hope, I mean, if I'm a lender and I'm looking at the closing disclosures and how I'm going to present them and be compliant, I'm obviously turning to technology to do that to some extent or another. You know, while I'm doing that, you know, the savvy lender is going to be like, okay, if I'm using technology for this, you know, where else can I use this same technology?
Right.
So, you know, whereas the technology was mainly used at the point of sale, so closing was really, you know, a very distant part of the process that was not top of mind for a lot of lenders. You know, closing is going to be very top of mind for lenders next year. And,
yeah.
you know, like I said, I hope they use it as an excuse to look at the whole closing process.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't make sense to me to use this one little piece of technology to solve this one little problem, especially when you can use some of the same technology to solve the entire closing process.
And really your whole process, you know, that's what we keep saying, is this is an opportunity to re-engineer your entire loan process. And that kind of plays right into having David T. Lord, our special guest on the show, as I think this is an opportunity, as you said. Lenders shouldn't look at it as a problem, look at it as a chance to maybe implement something like the e-closing. So, Tony, thank you so much for your feedback today and being on the show. I really appreciate it. And as always, very valuable information, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you for having me, Alice. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks. You too. Goodbye.
Bye now.
So as we segue here into our next segment, I want to give an introduction to David Lord. David and I met through Ross Mortgage. So for those of you who don't know Ross Mortgage, I think every state has those great long-term, family-run mortgage companies. You know, Ross Mortgage is an example of that. Hugh Ross, who started the company back in the 1950s, you know, one of the original mortgage bankers, I say. He's back in the day when you actually had to carry the loan and get in your car and drive it to New York to sell it and turn around, drive back with your money to be able to then sell another loan. So now Tim Ross runs that operation, and I was writing an article on efficiency and had the opportunity to look at how Tim's company had really transformed and just really took a look at their war room and saw this incredible constant project going on. Now, I've been in lots of companies where you walk through the halls and you see that there's some major project going on, but then, you know, the managers will admittedly say, yep, those sticky notes or that, you know, whiteboard has looked like that for about 6 months and no one's done anything with it. At Ross, they were actually, this was a constant living room. Their process was actually moving. So David Lord was is the consultant behind that. Dave is a coach and facilitator with over 25 years of experience working with businesses of all types and sizes. He helps companies identify the processes that need improvement and shows them how to make that improvement a reality. He's also helped with our process at Indicom Mortgage U, as we went from, you know, being a small training company to now merging in with a global organization. So David's particular area of expertise is the idea of visual management for enhancing communication. So I know people use a lot of buzzwords, you know, there's all the buzzwords out there, which I won't repeat. Picture that David kind of blends the best of all of those. His book is called The Visual System of Work, Help Your Business Work Better, Make Money, and Generate Cash, which was another mantra I loved out of David, was make money. We all have to try and make money. So Dave, welcome to the program. And Joe's going to join us as well in our conversation. So Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Alice and Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to, you know, after telling the audience a little bit about, you know, how we ended up asking if you could please share your knowledge, you know, can you share a little bit of background about yourself? Tell us a few words about, you know, your history.
Well, I just want to go back to some dear roots. Just being brought up in my family, I learned the importance of respecting people. And you need to respect your employees and your teammates. And team sports in high school especially gave me a lot of insight on working as a team member. And then being a school teacher for 3 years in the public school system here in Michigan gave me a lot of insight on teaching. Probably the biggest thing was years later, I worked for a company called American Supplier Institute, and it was there where I was introduced to the quality tools and with a special emphasis on process improvement.
So that now I understand too, and then since that time, as you've been a consultant, you've worked with multiple companies, which I always like. When you're looking to try and improve at the mortgage industry, you like that people are bringing ideas, especially in Detroit, right? We always have people wanting to say, bring in the manufacturing process. It works for automotive. So a quote by Stephen Covey communicates the need for what you do. Can you please share the quote with the audience and your thoughts on hearsay?
Well, when you think about being a business owner, you need to know, understand what's going on, and if you don't, your decisions will be flawed, distorted, incomplete, or inaccurate. And, for instance, with Tim at Ross Mortgage, he would have people constantly coming in his office giving their viewpoint of what was going on with the business, and as you know, that can sometimes be hearsay. So we needed to quickly visualize what was truly going on in his business. And a lot of these tools, I will start my 23rd year as an independent consultant, so working with many, many businesses, you know, has helped perfect this process.
So in that, you know, you talk about transparency. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things of what that means for you and how you work with that with your customers?
Well, with transparency, what I truly mean is you have to be open, frank, honest, and easy to understand. when you communicate. And if information is hard to understand, then it's not really truly presented in a transparent form. And that's where visual communication comes into play.
And so, you know, I bet you a lot of mortgage folks out there who are managers can relate to that, the fact that you have people coming in, you have sales telling you one side of the story, you have operations telling you another side of the story. So how do you translate that into, you know, documentable, maybe document's not a good word, but communication, you know, or actionable items that are transparent, fair, balanced?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, the place that we normally like to start is what we call the system of work, a very macro flow of the whole system. And it was fun when we got Tim and his vice president of operations, Patsy, in a room, and I just used stickies. And I wanted to see from them, at their perspective, how they thought the business flowed. And then it was very fun because once we got that documented, we presented it to his next level of managers, and sure enough, people had different perspectives, but we finally reached consensus on what we called what function, where they were connected, and then we really got down to who is responsible to pass on to the next department. And that's when it became very obvious that there wasn't a true shared understanding of how work should be performed.
And so talk a little bit about the accountability.
Well, accountability, I think it's very, very important that people need to understand what their duty is, what their tasks are, what they're responsible for. And until you really get that on paper, and what we used at Ross Mortgage and what I use at other businesses is called a task matrix, really getting on paper what people do on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis, and then share that with other people within the business because it might become a surprise to others what other people think they're responsible for. Also, probably the most important thing are the handoffs. For instance, you have a very important handoff from processing to underwriting, as you know. And when you have submission breakdowns, it can cause all kinds of problems in underwriting in what I call the civil war between originators, processing, and underwriting.
Did you say the civil war?
I call it the civil war.
Yeah, okay. A lot of people agree with that.
And, you know, when people aren't getting along, they spend a lot of time and energy, which is waste. And so what we did, we have this document that the manager of, for instance, of processing gets together with the manager of underwriting, and they reach a shared understanding of what is handed off, what to expect, and more important, if something isn't right, they decide ahead of time on how they're going to handle it instead of going back and forth to 15, 20 emails, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the email nightmare is just a loop that people can get caught in, and when they could have solved a lot of communication challenges and gotten straight to the point by just, hey, pick up the phone or walk over to somebody's desk, right?
Well, that gets back to making money because you waste a lot of capacity of actual work that you could be doing to get work through the whole process so you can secure that loan. Mm-hmm. And now what's great, once you have this, we call it a situation room. Some people call it a war room. But that's where we have our daily huddles, our weekly meetings. So at any given moment, if we have a question about an area of the business, we have a reference point that we can go to and observe just to take us back to how we should be working.
So, Joe, I'm going to pass it over to you. I know you have a couple questions for Dave.
You talked about transparency and how you communicate and accountability for what people are supposed to do with that information. So How do those two things help to build a better working environment, to get people to work better together?
Well, a lot of what this is based on is sharing information with people and allowing people to participate and share decision-making. So in the process of visualizing your process, understanding the handoffs, reaching consensus of how you want to play a game, it opens up, Joe, a tremendous amount of dialogue and conversation where people can actually share how they feel. But more important, when they do reach a decision, they're doing it together as a team, as mm-hmm. a group of people. And that really helps bring accountability along.
So I know there are a lot of people out there thinking, you know, our company needs some help or I need some help. So just how would you summarize, how do you help businesses work better together?
Well, first of all, you need to have a leader, the head of the body, that is sincere, that wants to go on this route. Because, as you know, in sports, where the head goes, the body goes. And so usually you make sure you have a leader that wants to bring transparency and accountability. And then you get a management team to buy in. And then you start building on these certain tools. I know, Alice, when we were working with your business, just to visualize all your projects, and to have more of a sensitivity of how much was on everyone's plate and how best to prioritize those items was very, very helpful.
Right. So you talk about the pillars, right, the three pillars in productivity, confidence, compassion.
Yes. Well,
so talk about, define your pillars.
Okay, well, on productivity, and sometimes people are uncomfortable starting this way, but if you do not make money and generate cash, you're not going to be in business, period. So it's very, very important to understand lag and leading indicators. Of course, your balance sheet is important and your income statement as well as your cash flow statement. But you need to know that the true measures that have the greatest impact, and that gets into your throughput, your sales, your operating expenses, and what I like to call is variable costs. And then from there, we drop that down into the system because it's all about the rate of flow in which work is going through your business that has the greatest impact on making money and generating cash. As far as confidence, in a nutshell, that means having people who are capable of doing the work. If people aren't capable, you're going to have a very difficult time of getting things done on time, correct, and accurate. And, again, that goes back to the sharing of information, shared decision-making, but it really begins to focus on process capability, people capability, and capacity. As far as compassion, I like to sum that up as working as a team. You have to really be gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger, and you need to have some mercy.
Mercy? Okay.
Yeah. And because people are going to stumble, they're going to fall, but instead of criticizing your people, help them up and help them grow. And that's where, to me, the center of a lot of this goes back to your core values, you know, of how you're going to run your business.
Well, those are all great components. I know Andy Schell would love that, you know, someone besides him, because Andy's always talking about that, making money and generating cash, that's really the name of the game. And you've got to know lag and leading indicators. You've got to have those set up. Now, a lot of us in the origination business think we know what those are, but I'll just say quickly, in the Fannie Mae sentiment survey I mentioned in my segment, out of 196 respondents, only 106 of them were not able to provide what is the cost of compliance, right? What is the actual cost of compliance in 2013 versus 2014, and where do you think it's going to be in 2015? So, you know, when you get somebody like Dave coming in and helping you kind of compartmentalize all of your projects, compliance ends up being one of those that's depleting your cash, so you've got to get a handle on it. But I was surprised that more than 50% of the respondents didn't even have those numbers to be able to identify, you know, truly their productivity. So I think that's a that's a key factor.
Well, you know, in the automobile industry, and by the way, I did work for Ford for quite a few years, you can catch an engine problem at the plant, but if you don't catch it until after a customer gets the car, those warranty costs can go way up. And it's come to a big surprise to me to see how mistakes go from origination to processing to underwriting through closing, gets all the way to warehousing, correct?
Right.
And it's a high degree that a lot of businesses lose about 1 month of revenue through a thing what I call leakage, where the money is just going away because of poor quality.
That's a good word, leakage, right? That by better process and product management, project management, you actually can save a lot of money. You save more money than you spend in trying to make sure people are together and community. So why is the visual system of management important? I think that's what I found so different about your approach compared to some of the others. You know, you're not some of these folks that come in are re-engineering your system in a way that starts to really be a drag, or that maybe the basic person doesn't understand. They just go, yeah, there's somebody in here and there's a big project going on, and it's like they're doing it for you. You're very involved, and it's about visual management. Can you share your thoughts about that?
Well, when you truly listen to the employees that are working at a business, when you go to a whiteboard and you start documenting what they're saying, first of all, you're going to quickly get a shared understanding of where they're coming from. And, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. I think you've heard that. We all have different perspectives of how we view life. And anyone will look at their perspective, and they will defend that they're right. And
right.
To have that proper leader to allow people to express their different perspectives and come together, eventually you will get a shared understanding of the true perspective of your business. And you can do that through process flowcharts. You can do that through task matrices. You can do that. A tool that we use a lot is just in projects, because besides your regular work, you'll probably be involved in a project. And Alice, you were introduced to the 5W2H form.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, that was a way to visualize all the steps that you could share with other people. By the way, folks, these are the things that need to happen for this project to be successfully implemented. And then you get those on a wall, you get those in a workspace. Now, a lot of times I will have some resistance from people in IT. They say, well, David, you can just go to your computer. Well, go to a Pistons ball game, and if everyone had to use their handheld devices to keep track of the score, it would make you not be able to watch the game. And that's why we have scoreboards at all these sporting events. But try to find a scoreboard in most businesses. It's very difficult.
I like that analogy. Go. I know, Joe, I know you have a couple questions.
Yeah, no. Well, I just wanted a little more on that. You know, the term visual management is quite frankly, a little vague to me, but it's getting clear in that you're talking about, you know, some very, very basic stuff that you can do to put this in front of a number of people all seeing the same thing and hopefully learning from it. So give us a few more examples of how you really facilitate being using visual management.
Well, usually to save costs, I have people go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy these whiteboard sheets for about $18 and get them up on walls. and so people have a place to write their information. And also, my wife has helped me many, many times go to Joann Fabrics, get fabric, and we put it over this foam board that we get over at Lowe's or Home Depot, so we can make storyboards so people can pin and post their information. The thing that Tim is doing at Ross Mortgage, all of his managers have a 4x4 board that's in their offices, and it shows their task matrix, it shows their meeting matrix, it shows their time matrix, it shows their different projects are on, and then they all have a whiteboard, and they have a 2-week calendar, and they have all their priorities of what they intend to do. Tim goes to their office, and they have a conversation. So it's a very, very fast process that he can get updated on what they're doing. It makes sure that they all are on the same page and that it's very transparent, Joe, and it's very accountable to hold people accountable because they're writing up on a board what they intend to get done. And then the following meeting, Tim can go in and he can find out if they got them done or the task done or not.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like what I remember in my early days as a CPA, having to document systems and develop the process and the flows to diagram all that.
Well and I think what I like is it's, yeah. Well, and one of the things I did like about David's style is it was not trying to come in and make you use a high-tech computer system. You know, I just think people today spend their whole life in front of their computers, and it was really nice to get out from behind that and have people talk face-to-face. So that's where I think, you know, some people go, oh, that's kind of low-tech, just use a whiteboard and a cloth. Yep, you know what, that's how easy, because then there's no barrier to entry, right? No barrier to get starting.
Well, that's a nice segue into a acronym, and I think I believe I shared this with you and your team, Alice. It's called USA. First, you should understand how your business works. Then you should simplify it, and then and only then should you automate it. And there is a tendency to automate something before it's truly understood and simplified. And this is a wonderful way to slow down. I know in my coaching experience, I watched a lot of film, and even in high school, and it was good just to go in and slow things down and really look at technique and to improve. And by getting things up visually, I believe it has a great effect on slowing things down so people can have a better, not only just an understanding, but appreciation of the business.
Well, the clock on my on-air broadcast is showing I have about 18 seconds left, David. So do you have a closing thought for us here today?
Well, I have a quote, and I did not know the author, but I come to this many times. It says, "We cannot go back and make a new start, but we can start now to make a new ending." And we all have our ups and downs, but let's learn from them and let's just get a new vision for success.
Well, that's a great way to kind of close out our program here. I think, as folks look to solutions, you've given them some good ideas, even to get started on your own. The other thing I liked about David's book was you didn't, although I recommend having Dave come out, it was a tool to help get your company energized. For those of you who don't have big budgets and everybody's trying to watch the bottom line, the book itself is also very valuable, so hopefully folks will take advantage of that as well. Well, I want to thank everybody for your time today and looking forward to talking with all of you next week. Dave will be back next week to be able to host our show, and we look forward to another hot topic and another week of great information. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, everyone. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This has been Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lincoln of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.